Marriage and the marriage relationship is God-centered. It is God-created. You cannot apply all of the principles that are involved as far as psychology and all of the principles that are involved in relationship to all the books written about marriage to marriage in the way that God created it. It does not work. All of the books that I asked you to buy, some of which I understand, one of the ladies mentioned, Diana, told me that Fascinating Womanhood is apparently out of print and difficult to come by. There are a couple of other books that could, in the same way, fit into that context. Total Woman, which many years ago, a lot of the people here in the Ann Arbor area particularly, went through not only having, I think, Mabel Morgan or one of the people who was with her organization come out here for the Ladies Club. There are other books of the same type, none of which are going to provide exactly the balance in relationship to marriage that God intended. All of which, however, can provide information and instruction in establishing how the relationship of marriage itself should work. What to tell you as to where to look for a chair, but you can look if you can find one. There's a bench up here in the corner. It's a little hard, but you might give it a try. I would rather, as much as possible, you try and stay together as husband and wife, if you can, rather than, I know you'd like to stand up and let the ladies sit down. I don't really know how we're going to solve the problem. We've run out of seats and space and everything else. Maybe we'll try and part and switch, and you can half stand and half sit down, or whatever you can work out. God created marriage with the intent of accomplishing two things, and I covered those things pretty much on the Sabbath in relationship to what marriage itself is. Marriage is based on reflecting, for us in a physical sense, what God's kingdom actually pictures, what Christ's relationship to the church pictures. Marriage also opens up the greatest opportunity for human beings to deal with each other in a very close proximity in their differences and in the problems that it creates by living with another human being 24 hours a day. There is nothing that generates more people problems than putting two people together in the same place for a protracted period of time. Because after a short period of time, you find out all the faults, all the problems, all the things about that individual that you really don't like. Whether they are spoken or unspoken, they come to be learned over the period of time that you're involved within marriage itself. Now, the principles that I want to talk about tonight deal primarily with communication from God's point of view. They are not techniques from a psychological point of view of how to learn to speak better to each other. They are not techniques from a psychological point of view of how to accomplish certain goals in learning how to be more assertive, like we're going to have an assertiveness seminar that's coming up. Some of those things are very practical and are very usable. In a marital relationship especially, after a period of time, it falls into a very stagnant routine. And oftentimes that routine itself gets to be very repulsive to the people that are involved in it. Now, within the church, the purpose for the whole series that we're dealing with in marriage itself is that Mr. Hampton and I have observed in the last couple of years, and I mentioned this well over a year ago when I first intended to do this in an entirely different way, that we have a great many marital problems within the church. Those problems come from a variety of sources. Some of them come from the fact that people got married for the wrong reasons, but nevertheless they're now married within the confines of what the doctrine of the church teaches and therefore have to stay together. Others of them come from the fact that people themselves have individual problems, and those problems in a marital relationship have caused additional difficulties. And understanding how to solve some of those things from God's point of view and principles that can be used will provide a basis for dealing with solving some of them. I don't anticipate with anybody that I sit down and talk about concerning marriage, whether it's person-to-person in marriage or in a group situation like we're doing right now, that there's going to be a dramatic change in the course of the next day or week or month. Change comes very slowly to people. And change in a situation where it's an instructor versus someone who's listening and trying to learn, it comes a great deal more slowly. What we can deal with, though, are principles that will work. And if they can be understood and accepted and can be used, then there's something that you will find benefit and value from as you go on, starting some this week, starting some maybe tonight on your way home, but over the course of the next several weeks and months, you should be able to use them in a way that will work in relationship to the marriage. I mentioned on the Sabbath in explaining the relationship that God created in marriage, that marriage itself is based this way. God created man to function at a job, at a task, at work, to provide for the home. I'm going to talk about some of this on the Sabbath that's ahead of us. He created a woman to be a help for a man. That is a foundational principle for marriage that we cannot change. It cannot be altered. We can say we don't want to accept it, but we cannot alter the fact that that's how God created marriage to work. Within that context is why I have restricted the Bible studies themselves to people who are both converted, both members of the church, both seeking to follow the principles that God has laid out within the structure of marriage itself to learn how to improve their relationship with God. Such is the situation tonight, that we have you here in a rather captive state over a period of about an hour and a half to talk about certain things that relate to both of you, that both of you can hear, that both of you can listen to, and that you can sit down and begin to evaluate in your own particular circumstance. Now, when you look at any marriage, no two marriages are the same. No two people are the same. But the principles that govern the relationship are the same. Learning how to use those principles, learning how to function within that marriage, is the most important aspect of making the marriage succeed and be happy itself. I don't do these principles all myself. I don't pretend to do them all. I know them. I understand what they are, and I should do a better job at doing them than I do. My wife knows them, and she understands what they are, but she doesn't do them all perfectly either. Marriage itself pictures a perfect relationship between Christ and the church. Our situation as human beings is that we are not perfect. None of us are. Our relationships one to another, especially in a marriage situation, are built mainly on imperfections. One of the things that's very difficult for people to understand, and I don't really know why, I see it more in myself than I ever thought that I would the older I get, and perhaps that's what's involved in it. The older you get, the more of it you see. The practical fact is that all of us duplicate, almost without exception, the things that we saw our mothers and fathers do. It does not matter what the marriage principles are that are right. We do what we saw mom and dad do. If mom and dad did it this way, you know, if you're a man and you were young and growing up, and this is the way dad was, he never did put his arms around the kids and hold on to them and sit down and talk to them. He never did that to you in your whole life. The odds are extremely great you never will either. Doesn't matter. If you know that it's wrong, you won't do it because that's the way mom and dad did it, and therefore that's the way that's accepted as being correct. All of us can look back at some of those things and realize that they are not right, but we don't understand just how greatly our personalities have been shaped by those things and how inhibited we have become because of them. Now, my wife and I are extremely different, and I'll use us for examples. I told Amy that I would not use her too much tonight for an example. Many of you go back and tell these stories out of school to my wife, and don't tell them exactly the right way, and I'm going to come looking for somebody with a shotgun, because she'll be looking for me with a shotgun. My wife comes from England, as I think most of you know, more specifically from Belfast in Northern Ireland. I come from Chicago. We are totally different as far as our backgrounds are concerned. My wife comes from a very conservative, very structured Protestant home. Her mom and dad married during the war. Her mother died when she was 6 years old. She had her dad remarried within a year or two later, and she had a stepmother and two older sisters. She was an only child. It was her father's only child and only life. I came from a family of four. My dad was quite an interesting character, to say the very least. Very adept at doing a multitude of things, very talented man, and my family was always involved in going and doing things. I was always involved in going and doing and expected to go and do and expected to produce things, and if I did not, I would find myself in hot water because I did not. Very different in our relationship. Uniquely, though, my wife and I are both Scottish. Her parents were both Scottish, married in Northern Ireland, and their ancestry can be traced back with no problem to Scotland. My parents met and married in Chicago. Are both Scottish. My dad was born in Paisley. My mother was born in Bucky. They met in Chicago, Illinois, of all places, married there, and turned out a bunch of pure Scots. My wife and I, by happenstance of who knows why, met and married, having met in England, both of us in background 100% Scottish, and both of us completely different as individuals. We've been married 11 years. I have not yet learned how to live with that woman and make her happy all the time. I have not yet learned how to hear the things that she says to me and understand the need that's reflected behind it. Neither has she learned those things about me yet. Now, that's in 11 years of trying. I mean, consciously trying, because the value that's there, I recognize for what it is. And for whatever reasons, by God just having taken me and literally kicked me around to make me understand it or whatever else it is, he's put me in a position to deal with it and to have gained some knowledge, some information from it. Okay, what I want to talk about now is based on this premise, and I don't want that to be lost any time during the evening, because if it is lost in your mind, If it's lost that marriage was created, God created man to function in a capacity to go out and work. God created woman to function in the capacity where man would be the center of her life, where her husband would be the center of her life. If that is lost sight of and misplaced, as far as the relationship that you have is concerned, any time, none of these things will work. And it has to be an acquired, learned knowledge. It has to be something that you recognize for the value that's in it. Okay, I want to cover, in total, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 principles dealing with communication. These are not techniques of communication. They are principles of communication. I'm going to give you a book, or recommend to you an additional book that you buy. You can buy it for, I think it's only $6.75, and I'm selling them on the way out. That's the way it is with most seminars you go to. Selling them on the way out. You go to the bookstore and buy them. You may find them here, in fact, in the bookstore, either one of the two that are here in the mall, or you'll find them at one close to home, and I'll tell you about it a little later on. Okay. The principles I'm going to be covered are drawn from the relationship of Christ in the church. They are not drawn from the relationship of person to person for the greatest amount. They're drawn from the relationship that marriage pictures, Christ in the church. And the principles need to be understood in that context. Now, we cannot understand all of the principles in that way because Christ in the church represents the ideal and Christ has no faults. Unfortunately, I don't know any husbands that don't have any faults. I could list a number of them, of those of you that are sitting here, as well as I could list my own. So the analogy does not hold true all the time, but it does, in principle, have to be the basis for what we look at. First of all, turn over with me, if you will, to Hebrews, the 5th chapter. Here the Apostle Paul is addressing a subject that is not related to marriage, but he is covering a principle that is related to communications. And it is a basic, fundamental principle. And I'm not going to cover these in any particular order of importance, just that I want to cover all of them so that you can understand and begin to apply, thinking about how to apply them between you and your husband, you and your wife. Hebrews, the 5th chapter, the Apostle Paul is in the midst of a discussion where he begins to get involved in who a high priest is and who Melchizedek is, and the whole structure that he begins to involve himself in here. Now, my intent is not to talk about that, but to draw on the principle that Paul brings out right at the very beginning of this discussion. And it's a principle that pertains in its same type to a husband and a wife, because the office is the office of Jesus Christ as far as a husband is concerned. And so invested within that office goes this same fault. For every high priest, it says in Hebrews, the 5th chapter and in verse 1, taken from among men, is appointed on behalf of men in things that pertain to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. And here he's talking about the literal physical office of the high priest, who in essence does represent Jesus Christ in the Old Testament. In verse 2, he brings up a principle that has to be understood by every husband. And it has to be understood because if it's not, the very basis for communication is going to be lost because of the authority that a husband has. He can deal gently, it says in verse 2, with the ignorant and the misguided. Now, don't blame me for the analogy meaning that wives are ignorant and misguided. That's not what I'm trying to say. But it's talking about the principle and attitude of someone in the office of Jesus Christ as a human being, which is really what a husband is in the picture of marriage. He's in the office of Jesus Christ as a human being dealing with his wife. He says he can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself also is beset with weaknesses. Herein lies a great principle in dealing with a wife and in working with someone else on the basis of Jesus Christ as a human being. You have authority as a husband, and that authority can be used to stop virtually anything that you don't want to have take place within a marriage. All you have to do is say no. And from that point on, you can close off anything else in dealing with your wife. The authority exists, but the principle oftentimes is not correct in the way that it's used. The point that I want to get at here is what Paul is mentioning in relationship to a high priest. That as a husband, you have to understand that you have faults yourself. And that when you're dealing with authority having faults, you must consider those faults and understand what they are because they are seen. When you as an individual lay down the law, when I do it, in relationship to an activity so far as the church is concerned, if I don't consider the fact that I have faults that somebody can point their finger at and say, hey, look, you can't say that because you do this. Well, no, that's true. I can admit that. I don't have any problem admitting that. But if I can admit it, then I can also temper the way that I require of other people what it is that they do on my behalf because of the authority that's invested in me. Same thing has to be true within the relationship of communications between a husband and wife. And if that is not true, by its very nature, it shuts off the capacity for any communication to pass from the wife to the husband. And after a period of time, the wife in particular, whose life is centered around this man, this husband, learns not to say anything at all. She learns not to talk, not to express the feelings that she has, not to express the emotions that she has, not to express the opinions that she has, not to express what she has thought within her mind, because she knows it won't be accepted, and because she recognizes the authority, she knows she must accept that decision. Now, if the principle within a man is not to understand that as a man, even though in the office of Christ, invested with that authority, and rightly so, if he is not capable of seeing and understanding his own faults and shortcomings, he is going to inhibit any kind of communication of value between a husband and wife, between him and his wife. And because of it, it says, because of the weaknesses that he has in verse 3, he is obligated to do something himself. In the high priest's case, to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so also for himself. Now, within the state of Israel, within the structure of Israel itself, and particularly at the time that was being talked about here, outside of the high priest, Moses, who was a peculiar prophet, meaning a special prophet in relationship to God, the high priest held the greatest authority within the nation of Israel, and certainly from a religious point of view, he held that authority. Same thing happened in the day and time of Jesus Christ. It was the high priest. And even when Jesus Christ spoke back to the man, and they hit him alongside the head and said, "Do you speak to the high priest that way?" And Christ said, "I didn't realize it was the high priest. I didn't know that that's who it was." He honored the authority that was there because of the office that was held. Same thing has to be understood within the relationship of the things that are here. That in communicating from a biblical point of view, based on God's structure within marriage, there has to be an understanding, an admission, and a willingness to admit the weaknesses that you have as a human being. Now, in our society, that's not a good thing for a man to do. We are all, every single one of us, as men, hooked into an American view of what masculinity is and what it means to be masculine as a person. And it means to be masculine in our society as a person and to be good in that concept that you have no weaknesses and you have no faults. You are reflected in, as we say within the parlance of our society, to be somebody like John Wayne, somebody like some of these masculine images that are portrayed. It's changing in the movies now. We get guys now that are heroes within the movies like Burt Reynolds, who builds his reputation on that, and the picture of masculinity in the whole society is changing. I'm not saying for the better or the worse here, I'm just saying that it's happening. But for us as a man, built within a man because he has the authority, is the fear of saying he did the wrong thing, of admitting the weakness that is there, is saying that I don't have it. It amazes me, and it doesn't all at the same time, the things that I will do that I know my wife does better, and I'll do them simply because I'm the head of the household. It's crazy. But unless I make a conscious effort not to do it, and not to be threatened by the fact that if Amy does it and does it well, that she ought to do it. That there's no question in her mind, because I don't have the capacity to deal with it, whether that's through character weakness, whether that's through personality weakness, whatever it happens to be through, if I don't allow her to do it, does that make me less responsible in the office of Jesus Christ as the head of the house and in the capacity to make the decisions? It does not, if it can be admitted and understood and accepted. But oftentimes the problem that gets related in a man's mind is that if I admit the weakness, then I will undermine my authority. Herein lies the fact of why, when I structured the Bible study, I structured it so that it was husbands and wives within the church who were converted. I am assuming, and it's an assumption that I have to make or else I can't accomplish anything in what we're talking about, that the wives that are here are going to be subject to the structure that God established in marriage, that they're converted and that's what they're going to be subject to. And they're accepting that authority. Even though it might be misused, misplaced, wrongly done, they're going to accept it. If it's possible for a man, for a husband, to establish that amount of trust in his wife that he will accept being able to say, I have the problem, I have this weakness, I have this fault. And that she will turn around and say, yeah, I know. You've always had it. You know, it's been a part of you ever since I can remember. I love you anyway. But, you know, you got it. You're right. There's no question about it. You know that once that happens, once it happens, just one time that it happens, and you find that your wife does not reject your authority or reject you as a person or reject what you are because of the admission of that, it's a whole lot simpler to do it the next time around. In fact, I find some husbands who've learned that in relationship to their wives will divest themselves of all kinds of things they don't want to do from that point on because they know they can't. And that's great. Because in the long run, what it does is it strengthens the relationship. It does not tear it apart. It does not undermine the authority that's there. It helps uphold that authority because you get away from trying to portray something that you are not. If it can be understood that it is not a personal sin to have a weakness in whatever area it might be. Now, I'm not justifying sin by saying that. Please understand. What I'm saying is the weakness exists. Admit it. And don't be afraid to. That's exactly what Paul is saying here. In verse 4, he says, no one takes this honor to himself, but receives it when he is called of God, even as Aaron was. In Aaron's situation, that was the case. In every high priest situation from Aaron on, it was by the firstborn of the high priest's family that it was passed on. And he didn't have anything to do with being the firstborn any more than anybody else did. He says, so also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest. Now, isn't that interesting? That in Jesus Christ's attitude, he didn't turn around and try and aggrandize the position he had as being a high priest. He actually is going to be both priest and king when he returns and establishes his kingdom on this earth. And this whole section leads to a discussion of Melchizedek, whom Jesus Christ was in the Old Testament and is now, as far as the structure is concerned. But Christ did not stand up and say, I am the authority, and therefore you will do as I say. In relationship to the church, in relationship to the world and those that are unconverted, there's no question that it must be that way. But in relationship to the church who are trying to learn, or a wife who is trying to submit to someone that she loves, there has to also be that understanding in the communication itself. Okay, he goes on and talks about in verse 5, he says, so Christ did not glorify himself to become a high priest, but he who said to him, you are my son, today I've begotten you, just as he also says in another passage, you're a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. In the days of his flesh, when he offered up both prayers and supplications, with loud crying and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and who was heard because of his piety, because of his willingness to do what was right. Although he was a son, in verse 8, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. Now, even in the picture of Christ in the church, and a husband in marriage, what Paul is telling us is that Christ learned by what he suffered and went through. Isn't so much so to be said for a man who can learn in the same circumstances in relationship to his wife, if he has the capacity and the willingness and the humility to be able to admit that and to be able to accept that, if such is the case, and not have the authority that he has be threatened. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Turn over to Philippians 2. We'll look at this principle just a little further. Come on in, and if you can find a seat, I tell you, you're welcome to come up if you want to sit up here in the front on this table, too. We can shuffle this stuff off of here, and you can use this table to sit on if you want to do that. Down the Mr. Ziegler, to turn off the heat, maybe it's too cold. All the ladies are going to start to freeze. Is there a middle in the middle you can find? Mr. Ziegler works here at the mall, for those of you that don't know. So he does, I presume, probably set the place up today as well. We appreciate it. Great deal. Philippians, the second chapter. That's where we were headed. Here Paul again talks about the office of Jesus Christ and the attitude of mind that Jesus Christ had in the office that he held, not only while he was on the earth, but as he holds it even now, in relationship to those of us that are part of the bride, part of the church itself. And again, the principle has to apply within ourselves. Philippians, the second chapter and in verse 1, he says, "If therefore there is any encouragement in Christ, if there is any consolation of love, if there is any fellowship of the Spirit, and if any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose." Now, in a marriage relationship, that supposedly is the commitment amongst converted members of the church of each of them, that we are united in spirit. It is God's spirit that is within us, begetting us as his children. It is one goal, one purpose, one intent that we're striving for, and that's to be a part of the family of God, to develop that character, to have the use of that spirit to produce that fruit that God is after and fulfill that purpose. Do nothing, in verse 3, from selfish or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Now, within a marriage relationship, I can't tell you how important that is from a husband to a wife. To a wife, her whole life is involved in what you say to her, about her, for her, against her, in relationship to how good or how evil she does something that she does. Let me give you an example today. Amy went out and was out during the course of the day and came back and picked up the kids. And it's during the course of the time of the month when she has her menstrual period, which is always a tough time for a woman. I don't care who the woman is. There's always a problem that's related to it, and it almost always gets involved in a feeling of depression and being down and being kind of separated and being kind of in a situation of just the feeling of detachment from what's going on in a home with everybody else. She came home today, and I was not thinking too clearly here. My mind was, even though I'm working on this and thinking about it, I'll give you an example of my own stupidity. She came in the door, and we were talking back and forth, and she said she was feeling lonely. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry to hear that. Why are you lonely?" And she proceeded to tell me, and I didn't hear what she said. Later on, we were talking a little while, just before she had to go out to take Becky to her ballet class, and I could tell that she was discouraged, you know, she was kind of depressed. And we were talking about something, and it came up in the course of the conversation that I'm going to have to go out of town in the early part of March. And I said that. Now, see, there was no relationship to me at all. I wasn't thinking about what I had heard her say earlier on. She told me she was lonely, and I told her I was going to leave town. I just didn't think. Now, I'm not leaving town for 6 weeks. She's lonely today. But see, the reaction was almost immediate in what went on and in what took place, simply because I didn't stop and think about what it was that she needs. Now, Paul is talking here and saying, don't do anything from a selfish or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Now, he's talking to the church, brother to brother. Now, you can't tell me, though, that in relationship to a marriage, where it's brother to sister, in the church, as well as husband to wife, the principle is not equally as important and equally as valid in terms of what must be done. Now, I'll tell you this, that in relationship to husband to wife, the one who must initiate the doing of good to the other one is a husband, because it'll be natural for the wife, because the husband is what her life centers around. And so for her to do the serving, for her to fill the need, for her to see the need, for her to function in that capacity is normal. For a man, it is not normal. It has to be recognized as necessary and then done, especially in the basis of being able to open up a channel of communication and an ability to understand what the needs of your wife are. Do not merely look out, it says, for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. And again, the principle applies within the structure of marriage itself, and certainly within the structure of marriage in a family. That's the whole goal that has to be involved. It's not just personally what you desire, but it's what you're producing. That's what God is doing. His whole goal is not just personally his desire, but it's what it's producing in his family and what that family is going to do. Have this attitude in yourselves. Now listen carefully, and this applies again to the men, much more so than it does to the women. Have this attitude in yourselves, which also was in Christ Jesus. In other words, here we're going to be told now the attitude of mind that Christ had as he walked on the earth, as he functioned and dealt with human beings, who, although he existed in the form of God, although he was literally God before he came down on the face of this earth, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. In other words, he didn't run out and say, this is what you must have. This is what I must have again. This is what I have got to maintain and that I have got to hold on to, and in no way at all will I allow myself to be deviated from it. Because then it in itself can lead you to a feeling of self-aggrandizement, of a point of tremendous importance. But look what he says the attitude was. But emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Now, the principle we'll keep coming back to as far as husbands is concerned is explained in Ephesians 5, where it says that husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. The principle that's involved here comes back to the structure and the way that God created marriage. A husband will go out and get the needs fulfilled as far as his own growth, as far as his own desires, as far as his own sense of self-worth, as far as his own values are concerned, when he walks out the door and goes and does the job that he does. He will get an immediate feedback from what he does. He'll get the money and the paycheck at the end of the week. He'll get the praise, hopefully, and the congratulations of those people that he works with. He will get back to himself what he gives out in terms of what his work is, and will see it in tangible results. He must do the same thing to his wife because she has to get it from him. And if it is not given, she will not get it anywhere else. She doesn't want it from anywhere else within the structure of how God has established that. If a husband doesn't understand that, if he doesn't grasp what that means and how that works in a marriage relationship, he will shut the door to fulfilling his wife's needs, and he will open the door to a lot of frustrations, a lot of things that will be pent up in her mind, a lot of things that she will not be able to express, because there will not be for her, from him, the fulfilling of those needs, the recognition of what those things are. He says, but emptied himself in verse 7, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by being obedient to the point of death, even to dying on the cross. He was that dedicated to what it was he had come to do. Therefore also it says, God highly exalted him, bestowed on him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, both of those who are in heaven and on the earth and those that are under the earth, and every tongue should confess that he is Christ. And the point that's involved is that by fulfilling the purpose that he came for, that he was given the job to do, everything came back to him. Being God, having eternal life, fulfilling the office and the purpose for his life came back to him by doing the job in the right way, by recognizing what it was. So then, my beloved, in verse 12, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work within you, both to will and to do his good pleasures. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, the children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. In other words, in your attitude toward each other and understanding how marriage works and what's there, what the attitudes of mind ought to be, one to the other, husband to wife. Within the structure of marriage, at the time that we baptize any individual, say husbands and wives, as you were baptized, turn back over to Ephesians 4 with me, if you will. There is a striking desire within us as human beings to have people not think there is anything wrong with us. Here again, it's all a part of our own selfishness and our own vanity. You know, it's very difficult for a human being to admit that there is fault or error, or that he's done something wrong. It's very hard to do. It's hard for me to do it. I hate it. I hate to do it. I hate to admit that I've done something wrong. Now, it's obvious to everybody when I do something wrong. And so it's not hard. You know, and sooner or later you have to swallow it, so to speak, and admit that you've done it wrong. In a marriage relationship, the same principle will happen because it's human nature that generates it. That within the structure of doing something wrong, there is the desire to say that it was not done, or to ignore it, or to make it work, because that's the way it's got to be, be it husband or wife. The structure that is involved in reality with God dealing with us as children is what? He takes us and says, look at yourselves, repent of what you are, and put on the mind of Jesus Christ over the period of time that I allow you to live from the time that you're baptized on. Whether that's 20 years or 30 years or 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, or whether it's 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months. The point is that from the beginning until the time that it's over, it's constantly a matter of doing what? Of admitting, repenting of, and overcoming weaknesses and faults and sins. That same thing is true as far as a marriage is concerned. You take two people who are totally independent, totally different in the way their life is, and who have to make themselves one unit. And it's a whole lifetime of learning to admit those same things. It's a whole lifetime of learning to admit those same things. It's a whole lifetime of saying, you know, I know that I did that wrong for the umpteenth time. That I said the wrong thing all over again, and drawing back and saying, I'm going to try and remember not to do it the next time. I'm going to try to remember to change so that it doesn't come back out that same way the next time. Okay, Ephesians 4 and verse 2. Here again is a principle that deals in attitude one toward another. And it's more important for the husband, and it's more important, and I'll harp on this, if you can call it that, over the course of the time that we'll deal with these Bible studies, again because of the structure of marriage, a wife around a husband and a husband around a job, but also again because it is the husband who is responsible before God. It is the husband who has the authority, and it is the husband as the head whom God will hold accountable for how he has dealt with his marriage and how he's allowed the growth of his wife and himself either to be hindered or to be expanded by his understanding of the relationship that's there. Okay, verse 2, it says, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, show forbearance to one another in love. That ought to be a hallmark in marriage, more than in anything else, and certainly more than in the church. It ought to be a hallmark within marriage that the attitude that you have toward one another is gentleness, humility, patience, forbearance, and love. And certainly in being able to talk to one another about whatever the subject is that comes up. Understanding the need for the other person to grow and to change. What happens is, though, that within a marriage, we tend to put such extreme demands upon each other. And when something is done wrong, because of the proximity physically of the people, because of the emotional involvement that is done, it is always taken with such enormous hurt when something is done wrong. It tends to remain there for such long periods of time after it has happened, rather than in a marriage where it ought to exist more than anywhere else, that forbearance and that gentleness and that patience and that love and humility is willing to be shown. Like I said, I hate to admit it when I'm wrong. When I get involved in a situation like that with Amy, I kick myself around. I know that I'm wrong. I kick it around and kick it around until I can finally swallow enough and ask God to give me enough guts to go say, honey, I'm sorry. You know, I said it the wrong way or I said the wrong thing. And I don't want to feel what happens, because once that division arises and once that wrong is done, whether it's me or her, either one, once it's established, you feel it build in getting between the two of you. And I don't want that feeling. I hate that feeling. I cannot stand it. And if it begins to happen, then I begin to back up and say, well, now, shall I sit here and wait for Amy to come to me, or shall I go to her? And depending upon which of us happens to be more converted at the particular time, it'll get done by one or the other of us, and usually within a very short period of time. I won't allow it to exist, even though I want to fight against it with all the human nature that's in me in order to be right, rather than to do what's right. And there is a big difference between being right and doing what's right. And within a marriage, that's a difference that needs to be understood. So the first principle that we want to talk about in communication is a principle of understanding and considering your own faults in relationship to each other. Okay, secondarily, and as I said, I'm not going to deal with these things in process of order, but just in points that I want to have covered and want you to understand. In a marriage relationship, in communications between a husband and wife, it is essential that you do not hold a grudge, that you do not bring up the past, that you do not go back and dig it up, whatever it was that happened yesterday, a week ago, a month ago, or a year ago. It is absolutely imperative in a marriage relationship where two people are so close together that you forgive one another your sins. Now you think about it in relationship to Christ and the church. What is it that separates us from God? Sin. What if God was unwilling to forgive you? Now, marriage is the picture of Christ in the church. What if he was unwilling to forgive you? What if he decided, no, I'm going to wait a year to forgive you? Maybe I'll wait too. And in fact, maybe I'm not ever going to do it. I think I'll hold on to it from now on forever, even though I'm going to live in the same house with you. And I refuse to forgive you for what you've done to me. What if Jesus Christ did that to you? Marriage pictures that relationship. What if he did it to the church? What if in the course of all the things that have happened in the last year in the church or in the last 10 years, Mr. Armstrong has said the church has been off the track for 10 years. What if Christ wasn't willing to forgive the church for all the things that we've done wrong, whatever they are, real or imagined, whatever they are? What if he wasn't? Where would that leave us in our relationship to God? And yet, in a marriage, one of the most damaging things that can be done is exactly that. That tremendous willingness by either husband or wife to bring up what happened yesterday. Not to forget it and say, boy, that was a mistake and I wish he'd never done it or she'd never said it. But instead, to bring it up and talk it over all over again. Throw it up in the air and do it over and over again. It is necessary to learn to forgive and to forget as best you can, regardless of what the hurt is. The hurt may last a long time, but the bringing it up again will help absolutely no one. Colossians 3. Mr. Sigler, you're going to have to turn that thing down. I can't keep taking off coats. I don't know if there's a way we can... Can we open a door or let the air circulate somehow? I don't know what we can do. Maybe that will help. Leave the heat on and get some currents and draft from one point or another. Otherwise, people are going to nod off and go to sleep. There we go. Okay, turn over to Colossians 3. Colossians chapter 3. Here again is instruction that Paul is giving to the church, but it applies in its principle within the framework of marriage even more so because of what marriage pictures. Colossians 3 and verse 12. It says, "And so, as those who have been chosen of God," Colossians 3 verse 12, "holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion and kindness, humility, gentleness and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you forgive the other." Now the principle is a lot more profoundly established in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus Christ says, if you will not forgive your brother his sin, then you can bet that God will not forgive you. In marriage, where the aspect of communication and the need for being able to talk to one another is so vital because of how close the relationship is in proximity with the other person. If you cannot forgive and forget what has happened before, and you keep digging it up and bringing it back up, then you end up constantly compounding that problem and allowing somebody to be responsible for their sins over and 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 over. Jesus Christ does not do that to the church. God does not do that to you. And neither should you do it to each other. If it happened, it happened. If it's done, it is done. And you just don't continue to bring it up and say it one to another. Let's take a look in relationship to that, to some of the things that the Proverbs say. I'm going to read the Proverbs out of the Living Bible. The Living Bible is a lot more picturesque than the Proverbs. So I think many of you are probably aware, if you studied Proverbs in the Living Bible, it's a lot more fun. Sometimes it's a lot more cutting, too. Proverbs 7. Proverbs the 7th chapter, or 17th chapter, I beg your pardon. I'll read my own notes, I'll be all right. Proverbs 17 and verse 9. Listen to what Solomon says and apply it to your marriage. In what you let come out of your mouth to your husband or your wife the next time you're tempted to do it. Proverbs 17:9. In the Living Bible, it's translated, "Love forgets mistakes." Love forgets mistakes. nagging about them parts the best of friends. See, now what is it? The best of friends, as far as a husband or a wife is concerned, better be each other. If it is not each other, then you're going to have a horrible problem. If you are going to include in your communication one to another on a continual basis things that have happened and mistakes that have been made, I don't care if it's about the children, I don't care if it's about the car you bought, I don't care if it's about the house you bought, I don't care if it's what you said to my mother, I don't care if it's what you said to my uncle, I don't care if it's what you did at the picnic, I don't care when it was, where it happened, whatever time it took place, if you don't learn to forgive it and shut up about it, you are going to constantly create a problem in your ability to talk to one another. It needs to be put aside and let go and not held up and say, oh, woe is me, you did this terrible thing to me 2 months ago, 2 years ago, 16 years ago, and I have never forgiven you for it. Then I tell you, on the basis of what the Bible tells us in Christianity, Jesus Christ hasn't forgiven you either. And in a relationship and husband and wife and being able to talk, if I constantly had to talk to my wife this way, I'd have the problem the Proverbs say, Proverbs 21. I think this is the one. Verse 19. And it says this in a multitude of ways, and it says it about women, but it's true about men if they do the same thing. Here it just uses the example. Solomon, being a man, obviously implied the fault to his wives. He had 1,000 of them, so it was easy to do, I'm sure. No difficulty. Well, actually, he had 300 wives and 700 concubines. You want to get the man married to more women than he was married to. Proverbs 21 and verse 19, it says, better to live in the desert than with a quarrelsome, complaining woman. And I'll tell you, he must have had a house full of them. No question about that. But there is the reality of what's here in principle. And it deals with this very thing. If you find yourselves in your communication with your husband, bringing out things, or with your wife, bringing up things that she did wrong or he did wrong, did him wrong yesterday, did him wrong 2 weeks ago, did him wrong a year ago, did him wrong a month ago, whatever it was, then you are barking up the wrong tree as far as being able to maintain a discussion, a relationship with each other that is valid, that is going to grow and build instead of tear down in what is taking place and what's happening within the marriage itself. There are many scriptures that deal with this. There are a lot of them that are involved, and I'm sure you can read a lot of them in the Proverbs and look at them. I don't want to dwell on it. You take the time to sort it out if you want more involved in it that's there. In Colossians, again, chapter 3, I want you to notice what Paul says to husbands and wives in an attitude of mind that deals with this same thing. Verses 18 and 19 now in the same chapter. Paul says, wives, be subject to your husbands, as is fitting in the Lord. That's what Christ established and created marriage and requires of women. Husbands, here's the instruction, and listen to how he says it. Love your wives. And do not be embittered against them. I find that's very easy to happen within a marriage relationship. And it often happens because of this very thing. And it happens because. Why? Because of the principle of what's involved and how marriage works. As a husband, you are the center of your wife's life. And if you do something that is wrong that hurts her, she's going to remember it for a long, long time. A long time. And if she doesn't learn to shut up about it, pretty soon you will become very hostile to her about that issue, about that example, about whatever that story is that comes up and is told, about whatever is involved in it. Bingo. It'll set off that attitude of mine, and pretty soon the attitude toward your wife isn't, I love you, honey, but get in the corner here and I'm going to straighten you out once and for all. And that's a bad situation, and it's tied very definitely to a principle here in communication that needs to be learned. Drop it and forget it. Get away from what's involved in it. Okay, another principle I want to move to as the third one here. Now, we've covered two so far. Considering your own faults, forgiveness, and the need that's involved there as far as communication is concerned. The third one is, don't assume that your spouse knows. Don't assume that your husband or your wife knows about anything that you want or that you need. Do not assume that he or she knows what you need or what you want. None of us, and I mean absolutely none of us, are mind readers. For example, you know, I recognized what Amy wanted when she told me today after I stumbled all over myself. You know, after I told her I was leaving town and she was lonely, and I recognized what was there. She didn't tell me what she needed. She really didn't tell me. But I recognized what it was because she did tell me if I'd have been smart enough to pay attention to what she said. What she wanted was she wanted time to be with me. We didn't have a lot of time. It wasn't a great deal of time. She came home at 4 o'clock. She had to take Becky out to dance class. As soon as she came back from dance class, I had to leave. And we had a grand total of about 25 minutes as we passed by. But once I realized in the course of all this had happened, it took about 10 minutes for the event to happen, and I realized what her need was. She didn't tell me. I recognized it, then I did it. I put down everything else that I had, and I went and stood in the kitchen and talked to her while she was fiddling with dinner. Now, it's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do something else. But it was what I needed to do because it was what she needed at the time, and she told me. Now, she assumed that I would know, and thankfully I did. Maybe I'm old enough, wise enough, or just have lived with her enough that I picked up those things, and you've done the same thing. It's a bad principle, though. What she should have been able to do, and maybe it's my fault that she couldn't, was say, Bruce, I need to sit down and spend some time with you. Come here and sit down. You know, sit down. Never mind anything and anybody else. Sit down. Now, the point that's involved is you cannot assume in your marriage relationship that your mate knows what you want. I don't care what that pertains to, whether it pertains to sex, whether it pertains to get up and take care of the children, whether it pertains to carry out the garbage, whether it pertains to I need some money, whatever it pertains to, you cannot assume that your husband or your wife knows what you want. If you do, you make a horrible mistake because it's entirely possible he or she does not know at all. All of us have needs, and we need to be able to say those needs, especially to our husbands and our wives. Doesn't make any difference what they are. And you can't assume that those things are going to be understood or perceived. Now, my wife has gotten to the point with me that she'll tell me a lot of times just exactly what I said. And this is a good example. I'll tell you the story. This is not something I need to do, but this is something that Amy needs. And I've used this example before. I could use a lot of others, but this one will do because it illustrates the point. Amy, as I think all women do, need to sit down next to their husbands. Just sit down physically next to their husbands. It's one of the reasons why I asked you to sit as husbands and wives, you know, particularly. It didn't work out for everybody, and I apologize for the seating and the standing in some cases. The point is that for the very same reason that God created a wife's life to be centered around her husband, there is a need within a woman for physical contact with her husband that is non-sexual, that doesn't have anything to do with sex, but that is just in the proximity of being next to him. I don't have that need. Now, I have a need to get next to my wife when I want to get her to bed. And most husbands do. And so at that time, we come up with all kinds of fancy ways to accomplish it. You know? All of us have our skills, and we'll talk about that a little later on. That same thing is not true for a woman. Now, this is a very important point as an example. It's why I want to use it. It is necessary for a woman to have physical contact with her husband that is non-sexual, that is non-threatening, but that is just in the proximity of having his physical presence next to her. It is essential. Now, Amy has gotten to the point, after 11 years of being married, for the last 8-9 months, if I'm at home and I'm not sitting down in the office, I'm laying down on the couch in the living room, and that's where I read. Now, she's gotten to the point, and I don't mind anymore. It used to be it irritated me when I was younger. You know, I'd get upset with her and say, what's the matter? What's going on here? I got to sit here. But right here? I mean, there's 6 other chairs, Mr. You got to sit right here. That's where I was dumb. She didn't laugh. She went away. You know, she'd go sit somewhere else. Now, she's finally gotten to the point, and I've finally gotten it through my head, right here, you know, right inside the old noggin. She comes in there and sits down, kicks my legs up off the couch there, does it gently, thankfully. You know, and then she'll pick them up and put them on top of her lap and sit there and knit. And I'll tell you, it's bad when you're trying to read and my wife is knitting. Reason is, she knits like mad. And you hear this constant clickety, clickety, clickety. Don't tell her I said these things. I really get in trouble. But the point is that she has learned to tell me that, and I now understand what it means. And so I learned to watch what I do in that circumstance. I learned to watch what I say. I don't make any suggestion involved in it. I don't say anything. I watch where I put my hands. I watch all the things that go with it, because I realize that there is a need in her that I have got to fulfill. Now, you know, I never knew it. I never, ever knew it. I didn't know it until she finally told me. She thought I knew it, but I didn't know it. Now that I've learned it, I understand what the need is that she has, and so I try to fill that need. Same thing is true with her and me in different ways. But by example, that same thing will be true in any area. Don't assume that your husband knows what you want. Don't assume that your wife knows what you want. Why shouldn't you tell him? Are you afraid that he'll turn you down? And the answer is usually yes. That he won't appreciate or understand. That she won't appreciate or understand what's involved. And therefore, I won't say anything. I'll just suffer. And I'll get this look on my face. And then when she asks me, I'll refuse to tell her. And around we will go. And oh, how tragic it is as we walk around with this cloud of doom hanging over us, and you look and you think, what did I do? And you don't know. And nobody ever told you. And so you can't know. And there is no resolution to it. Don't do that. It's a very tragic error. You need to learn to be able to trust your husband or wife and to tell them what your needs are, what the problems are that you're struggling with, what the things are that are going on. And the Bible says that the show of your countenance witnesses against you, Isaiah says. It shows in your face. And if you live with somebody 24 hours a day, they're not going to be dumb. They're going to be able to tell when there's something wrong. The next step is, will you tell them what that is? Well, look, you know, the reason I'm upset is because I needed this and you didn't do it. Why didn't you tell me? Well, I didn't think you cared. You should have known. And all the other things that go with playing this game that goes back and forth. Too bad. You both end up badly hurt, and you end up killing the communication that's there. You need to learn to listen and to hear the things that your husband or your wife says. Now, it's like with Amy. The example I gave you, it happened this afternoon. She told me, and I didn't hear it. She said, I feel lonely. Now, after I thought about it, I realized why. It's partially because of the mental and physical aspects of the menstrual cycle and the effect it has on her. I know she's in her menstrual cycle, and I know the effects because I've learned to watch them. But you know what happened? And I didn't. And she didn't ask and tell me, what I need is some of your time. Don't go away. And then when I popped out with, I'm leaving town for 3 days, boy, that just absolutely, you know, bingo, just shot her right straight through to the gut. And then after she went out, she got in the car and went out and picked up David at school and came back. That 10 minutes period of time, I realized what she had said. Only I didn't hear it, and she didn't directly tell me the first time. That's what you have to learn about each other. It's harder to do that way. Better that if it's just said, but sometimes it can't be. So you need to learn to listen to what is said, what those requests are for what they mean, and do something about them. James 1. James, the first chapter, verse 19. This you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear. Be quick to hear what is said. Slow to speak and slow to anger. Now the principle ought to apply very directly in marriage and in communication. That you need to learn to hear what it is that your wife or your husband is asking for and recognize it. And that means you're going to have to pay attention to it sometimes until you actually can learn to say to each other what it is you want. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. And that's what happens. If you don't say it openly, outwardly, this is what I need from you. And I'm saying it within the confines of what God says marriage is and what's lawful and right in God's eyes. If you can't say that, then as a husband or wife, until you can, you need to be able to learn to hear what is being asked for, what the requests are, what is involved. Sometimes it comes out as anger and hostility. It comes out as griping and complaining. And if you would listen to what you're being told in the griping and the complaining, it's a need that's not being fulfilled, that your mate is unable to just openly say, do this for me. I need it. Now, you know, when you go to Jesus Christ to have help with a problem that you cannot solve, how do you do it? Do you get in there and pray in the closet and not tell him what it is? You don't tell him. You assume that he's going to know. Now, God already tells us that he knows what we're going to ask for before we do it anyway. So that's an excuse a lot of times for people not to pray. But you know, when you have a real serious problem, thank you, sir. Appreciate that. When you have a real serious problem Do you pussyfoot around with God about it, or do you tell Him? I need your help to intervene on this job with my employer, otherwise I'm going to lose my job over the Sabbath. And if you don't intervene about this and make some kind of circumstance to work it out, I'm going to have to ask you to give me another job because I know I'm going to lose this one. You don't stop and say, well, God, you know, do whatever you want. You say it because He allows it to be said. In fact, He requires you to say it. Same thing is true in a marriage. It has to be learned and understood, and then it has to be done and applied. Okay. Two other things I want to cover here. After that one, don't assume that. And I think we've said enough about it to understand. And you can think about it and apply it in your own situation. You can discuss it in your own relationship and see if you can come up with some specific things to use as examples, you know, that you've assumed that your husband or wife would do. Okay? Listen, separately now, is the fourth item, to criticism from each other. Constructive criticism. I'll talk about the other side of it, carping, in a minute. Listen when your wife criticizes something that you do, or your husband criticizes something that you do, and do not assume, don't assume that it is against you that it's being said, but that it is about whatever it is that has been done. It's not a matter of value as far as you as a person are concerned, husband or wife. Not too long ago, I mentioned it on the Sabbath. A lady come up to me in the area here, fine lady, you know, and I restricted the Bible study to singles. And she trooped right up to me and she said, look, I got an unconverted mate. You're not helping me out at all. And I sit there and smile and say, that's right. You're absolutely right. I'm really not. And it wasn't my intention to do that. And I told her that. And she said, but that's not fair. How about helping us out? Shouldn't you help us out in what we're doing in the situation that we have? And I said, yes, you're right, I should. Now, that was a criticism of what I was doing. See, now, it was not my intention to harm her or to leave her out. It was just that it couldn't all be done at the same time. But she came up and she said it quite openly. Bang, here you are. Chew on that for a while, Fred, and all the good things you think you're doing. How about this? You're not helping me out at all. Okay, you ought to be able to listen when the criticism that is given, the advice that is given by your mate is valid, and divorce it from what it is that you as a person are and attach it to whatever the action is that was done. And realize that you can be wrong. That it could have been the wrong thing to do, or that you have not met what the necessary aspect of the need is that is there. Listen to that. Be willing to accept it for what it is and take that advice. Let's read out of the Book of Proverbs again. And I'm going to read it from the Living Bible once more. You read it in whatever you happen to have there. Proverbs 21, this time in verse 29. Here it's addressed to the person with authority, but it applies again in principle to both, as far as communication is concerned, or criticism, or advice about going to do something, be it from you as a husband or from you as a wife. And again, the authority factor enters into this, but read what it says. Verse 29, Proverbs 21. An evil man is stubborn. Okay? Just plain stubborn. But a godly man will reconsider. You know, if you make a decision on whatever it is that you happen to be deciding to do, I don't really care what it is, and your wife comes up alongside of you and says, this is not a good idea, and I don't like this because of this, 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 and this, and you stop and you step back and say, well, I don't care whether you like this, 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 and this or not. I'm the guy making the decisions, and therefore this, 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 and this is the way that it's going to be. Now, what you've effectively done is you have taken away the capacity for someone that God has sent to help you, who looks at you, particularly as a husband, and says, look, what you're doing is going to hurt you, and then it's going to hurt me, because you are me. And I see that in terms of what's there. This is another principle we're going to talk about on the Sabbath, as far as husbands and wives are concerned, and again, it's tied to the structure of marriage. Why is it that in Ephesians, Paul says, no man has ever yet hated his own body? Why doesn't he say that of a woman? Why doesn't he address that to a woman? Why does he address it to a man? Because in a marriage relationship, the woman becomes a part of the man. And if the man hurts himself, he automatically will hurt her. And that's why he says that no man hates his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it and feeds it all his good junk that he loves to have, and drinks all the stuff that he wants to drink, and does all the things that he wants to do to satisfy his flesh. But you know, when that part of your flesh cries out against you and says, too much, you got to get plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Well, that's your wife sometimes that's talking to you. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. It's her that you're hurting by what you're doing. And you have to learn to be able to listen to what's there, because sometimes she's telling you what you have not seen or have not perceived, and you misplace what's there. And you need to appreciate the advice, the counsel, the structure of the individual that God has given to help you, to be a part of you, to function within what you are, and to hear it. If you don't learn to do that, after a period of time, you know what happens is that it ceases to come. You shut it off altogether. If you take it and you malign it, or you say, oh, there's no value to that, or when you go do whatever it is that you've done, and it comes back and doesn't work, if you don't say to her, you were right, and I was wrong, if you don't admit it, and you uphold yourself, even in spite of the mistake in the error that's there, you undermine your position of authority, the respect you ought to have, and you hurt your own flesh because you hurt her and her relationship to you. You need to listen. You need to understand, and that goes both ways, husbands to wives and wives to husbands. More important from a husband to a wife because, as Paul says, and we read on the Sabbath, a woman was made for man, not a man for a woman. But the woman was placed there to be a help, a counselor, an advisor, someone to be a sharer in what's there and who becomes part of what you are. And you have to appreciate that. It doesn't make you less to do that. It makes you more. Proverbs 28. Verse 13. Proverbs 28, verse 13. Again, from the Living Bible. It says, a man who refuses to admit his mistakes can never be successful. It's not possible. And in the structure of a marriage, it is ultimately the man, it is ultimately the husband who says, we will do this or we will do that. And you are the one that has to hold the accountability here, and it's addressed to a man. But if he confesses and forsakes them, he gets another chance. And that's exactly the way Christ deals with the church. It's exactly the way Christ deals with us. That if we ask him to forgive us, he'll do it, and he'll say, okay, now get up and do it again. Go on. Do it right this time. We'll try to do it right. Same thing is true with a wife. If you nurture that within her. If you don't, then you're going to end up having an enormous problem from her in relationship to that. In the same context of learning to listen to that advice and that criticism, either from a husband or from a wife. Because the same thing will be true with a wife. You have to learn, as a wife, that when your husband corrects you or tells you something that you've done wrong or says, this is not the way to do it, not to take the correction as a personal thing that he doesn't love you anymore. And that's the way that most women will react to it. Oh, no, you don't like me anymore because I did the wrong thing. It's not the point. The point is, learn that it is the wrong thing and I don't appreciate it being done that way and do it another way. Change the thing that's there. I'll give you an example of this that I have done with my wife that regrets me that I did it this way all the way till today. It happened to me again today. Here's one I can tell you about myself. I am a pain in the neck for being on time. I hate to be late. I hate to be held up by something. It bothers me, irritates me. And I get really upset about it. And when I've committed myself to be somewhere at a particular time, I want to be there. Now, over the years that my wife has lived with me, she has learned how much that bugs me. And when she goes out and is gone and I have the kids and she knows I have to leave at a particular time, I'll ask her, you know, please be back at. Normally, I tell her, don't be later than. You better show up by and make it imminently clear to her what time I would like her to be back. Well, when I was younger, I did it that way. Now that I'm older, she's learned how important that is to me. But still in all, when something happens that makes her late, she has an automatic fear of my reaction when she comes through the door. She's afraid that she's really going to be in hot water because she's made me late. Happened tonight. She took Becky up to dance class, and normally she'd be up there and back by 6 o'clock, and I could have left because I wanted to leave in order to have enough time to talk to Mr. Lufer and get over here before the Bible study started to make sure that we had enough space set up and that everything was going to work out all right. Mr. Sigler would do a good job, but I wanted to physically be here to see it. Well, as it turned out, coming back from Northville down Sheldon Road, she ran into one of our famous slow freights. And she sat there, and that freight train went by, and it stopped, and it went by, and it stopped. And she knew that at the house, where she could not get to, there was this dumb klutz hung up on time who was looking at his watch wondering, where is my dim-witted wife? Now, the only difference was that over the years, I've learned not to do that. And while I was at home today, I was not doing that. But when she came in the door, I could see it written all over her face, and she opened that door, and she thought, what am I going to get hit with? What's he going to say? She knew where I was going tonight, and she knew what I wanted to do, and she knew how little the time was. We're down to one car at the moment, and that's a problem for us. You know, usually when there's two cars, it doesn't matter, but one car hangs us up on a pretty tight schedule. And she knew. Now, the point that's involved is, you know, that she is trying to learn, and I am trying to get her to learn. But I don't want to do that to her. I don't want to force that kind of reaction out of her. She's too nice a kid. I like her too much. I don't like to do that to her. But, you know, in me is where the problem is. It's not in her. And she's told me that. At times when we're not pressed for time, she has told me how much it irritates her that I do that. And so I try to learn. I've tried to learn over the years to modify my behavior in that area so I can deal with myself and I can also deal with her. Which comes down to the point sometimes of telling her I want to leave in half an hour before it's time that we absolutely go out the door. Or whatever, in order to allow myself the time to sit down and breathe easily, in order for her to have a time to function around and to work toward. And if she's late, I can live with it. Sometimes it doesn't work for a long period of time because she realizes that you plan to leave a half an hour later than you actually are. And she doesn't get tired. Some wives are really conniving. Okay, next point I want to cover in relationship to listening to criticism or advice one way or another is don't insult each other. Now, when I'm talking about any of the things that I'm talking about here in relationship to Amy and I, and I'll use us for examples because we're as good of an example as anybody else that I know in a lot of these things. I hope you understand that anything I say is in the nature and the form of, you know, good-natured jesting just for the concept that's there. Don't anybody go out and say that I called my wife this, that, or the other thing, because I would be very upset, and I would not, you know, call her that at all. And many of you that know her and know her well know what kind of character, what kind of person she is. She's a terrific gal. Okay, point is, I want to make next in communication is don't insult each other. Don't allow yourselves to resort to sarcasm. Don't allow yourselves to resort to calling of names or the insinuating of motivations or attitudes. Don't do that. That is horribly damaging, not only to each of your respect one for the other, but also to children that are in the home and in the family that have to hear or see that reflected one to the other. In relationship to communication, when you resort to the form of name-calling, you have resorted to the aspect of being juveniles and being kids, like sitting down listening to David or Brucey and Rebecca stand there and calling each other dummy. You know, hey, dummy, what did you do that for? You know, well, look, I'm not the dummy, you're the dummy, at about which time I get involved in a conversation and say neither one of you are dummies, but you're both in a lousy attitude, and we're going to sort it out here. Somebody go get me a paddle, and we'll sit down and discuss this rationally. Now, in a marriage situation, when you resort to doing that, insulting one another, in terms of what you've done or what has happened or what has taken place, you have resorted to that level of communication. And it is absolutely useless and does nothing but damage one to another. And the principle involved from a biblical point of view is horribly damaging. Again, in the Proverbs, let me just read a couple of them that cover it and that show what is there and what you ought to consider in relationship to how you say the things that you do say. Proverbs 12, verse 18. Some people like to make cutting remarks. It's a part of their nature. In fact, I'll tell you somebody I know very well who used to do that all the time, and sometimes does it still to this very day. That's me. I have always been, and it is a trademark of what I grew up with in Chicago, of being a sarcastic blankety blank, you know, and all the things that went with it. It's a part of the nature and the background that I grew up with. Not from my family, but just from the atmosphere in terms of where I went to school and how I learned to survive and all the other things that were there. It was a part of what was there. It took me years to even recognize that I did it. I wouldn't even think about it. You know, it was just a part of me, just the way that I did it. He says, some people like to make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise soothe and heal. The words of people who really have understanding and knowledge in what it is that they're doing and saying one to another are said in such a way to soothe, not to cut, to heal, not to wound. And that's very essential in whatever the disagreement is you might have, whatever the discussion is that you're involved in, that you do not allow yourselves to get down on a level of cutting at each other. Proverbs 15. Proverbs 15 and verse 4. Gentle words cause life and health, All the things we've talked about in several of the other principles, gentleness and meekness and humility, one toward another, and especially in a husband toward a wife, same the other way around, but especially there. It says, gentle words cause life and health. Griping brings discouragement. Cutting at, striking out at, insulting, being sarcastic, attaching a name to, you know, just saying it off the cuff, all that brings is resentment and discouragement to another individual, especially husband or wife. Proverbs 25, verse 15. Good example of that, if you go back and look at Michael and David, when David danced at the ark, if you go back and read that, the attitude that was there, and something that never should be done, in any, regardless of what the problem is. Proverbs 25 and verse 15. Be patient, it says, and you will finally win, for a soft tongue can break hard bones. Contrary to the way human nature is. Human nature wants to strike out and make it even. Stand up for itself. Make it right. Equalize the situation and make it turn out the way you want it by saying it. It's the wrong principles. This is contrary to human nature. But so are a lot of the things that we're talking about contrary to human nature itself. There's a book out that is very interesting to read. I don't subscribe to all the principles that are involved in it, but I'll tell you what, and some of the things that I've learned from it, I have found they have worked for me. The book is called Contact, the First 4 Minutes, written by a psychologist, and his writing deals with the subject of personal relationships. And he said, in studying personal relationships, and you can go pick up the book and read it, it's in paperback, it costs a couple of hours, it's an interesting book. He said, in studying personal relationships, the conclusion that he has come to is that the first 4 minutes of personal contact with another human being are the most important 4 minutes that you have to deal with that person. In that 4 minutes period of time, and this is the average that it is, you will determine whether you want to keep talking to that person or you don't want to talk to them. You will determine whether you want to be friends with that person or you don't. You will determine in the morning when you wake up and turn over and say good morning to your wife just exactly what kind of attitude and mood she's in by the response that you get. You'll determine it with your children when they walk in the door or when you greet them in the morning. That first 4 minutes, in general, is going to set the tone for the contact you're going to have for the remaining time that you're either together or you decide, no, I don't like this person, and you go on and talk to somebody else and find somebody else. It's a very interesting premise. And involved in the concept of communication, I've tried to learn to do that, especially with my wife, especially with my kids. And I'm trying to learn to do it with other people as well. That I'm conscious of what is said, what takes place, what the interchange is in that very first few minutes that you actually sit down and spend time with whoever it is that you're talking to. Interesting book. Okay, that's not the one I wanted to recommend to you, by the way, but it's there. All right, I want to move on from there. And the aspect of not insulting, not dealing with it for the sake of time, I can't dwell on it too much longer, it's already 10 to 9. F, sixth point that's involved, or seventh point, I guess it is. Is that seven? What's F in the alphabet? Six. I'll be able to count. I watch Sesame Street once in a while. Okay, if you cannot talk about something, if you're unable to communicate to each other by talking about it, I suggest that you resort to how you used to communicate before you were married. And for most people, that was by writing. Put it down on a piece of paper and give it to the other person. Eliminate all of the things that are involved in dealing with person-to-person contact where you look your husband in the face and you lose all your courage. Are they telling us something will happen? Is it time to go? Oh, okay. I just thought they were telling us we got to go. If you can't talk about it, in other words, if you can't tell your husband or your wife what it is that's on your mind and you can't find the capacity to do it, then go back in your relationship to a period of time before you were married when you used to write. Don't use the telephone. You know, that's hardly practical in relationship to it. But sit down and write what it is you want to say and give it to him. Write it to him as a love letter. Write it to her as a love letter. Sit down and write it out. And just give it and say, you know, look, honey, I couldn't find quite the muster to tell you these things, but I've got to tell you. In and amongst the fact that I love you for all this, that, and the other thing, these things really do bother me. Whatever they might be. Now, some of the things that are involved, one of the suggestions in the book, in fact, that I'm going to recommend to you, is that you create what's called a suggestion box. And it's a suggestion box, one that says him and one that says her, your name and your wife's or your husband's, whichever way it is. The agreement that you have to make, though, is that when you put the suggestion in the box, it's not griping, it's not carping, it's not critical from the point of view of I don't like or I don't want or whatever, but it's genuine from the point of view of a need or a requirement that's involved. And the other agreement that is made in relationship to it is that when you take out the suggestion out of the box, when it's in the box marked George, and you come along as George, He's not George, are you? No. And you take out that suggestion. The agreement is that there won't be any opening up and reading the suggestion and then standing there and arguing about it. Now, this is from a purely psychological approach that they're using it. You know, this is how to reason it out and how to do it, not based on any of the things we're talking about as converted people within the marriage and the structure that God has established. But the principle would work if you would use it. If there was a need that was there that you could not express, you could not say, that you put it in there. And the agreement is, well, when you go by and take that suggestion out and read it, that you take it somewhere where you can pray and be by yourself and think about it and realize that I love you. Might even write that on it, you know, I still love you, even though you do this to me. I still love you. And consider what's there. And find, use that means as a means of communication. That might work for you. It might work to just sit down and write it, so that you're not threatened by the physical presence of the person that is there, one way or the other. You might try it, see if it will work. Last thing I want to talk about, two more things in communications. I'm going to pass over these quickly again because of time. That is that when you communicate and talk, talk about specific things. Don't talk in generalities. When you finally get down to talking and discussing and communicating about life and what it is, talk about specific things. Talk about the future. Talk about what your goals are. Talk about what your hopes are. Talk about what your dreams are. And be willing to hear and listen to those things from your husband or your wife. Talk about the kids, what their growth is, what their needs are, what things you need to do for them. And sit down and talk about them and communicate about them in specific ways. One of the things that is a very essential aspect for a man to learn and a woman to know in communications, and I want to talk about this just briefly in the same thing in talking about specifics, is this. That in the process of making decisions between a husband and a wife, it will happen this way. You're going to sit down and talk about a subject. We need to get Johnny into piano lessons because he's musically inclined. How are we going to do that? And you begin to sit down and talk about it. What will happen is that the wife will begin to talk. And she'll be talking about, well, we can do this, and I know this lady, and I know that, and what time of day can we do it? I can't figure out that. And then all of a sudden, the husband will say, here's what we're going to do. And you'll tell her. And she will probably listen to you and think, well, that's a good idea. That'll work. That's fine. But it'll drive her crazy after a while. What happens is that men tend to converse in conclusions. Women tend to converse in the process of deciding. Now, you stop and think about it in relationship to your marriage situation, and you're going to find that it's true. That a husband will just think it through while all the talking is going on. He's listening to what she's saying, maybe. Maybe he's not. And he's rationalizing all through, and then he's going to tell her at the end what the decision is before she's gotten there. And it drives women absolutely crazy. Frankly, the conclusion may be absolutely right, but she's not really interested in the conclusion. It's the fun of getting there that a woman enjoys. A man does not. Now, if you want to learn how to talk with your wife, you've got to learn how to not talk in answers, but how to talk in the process of getting to the answer. And it will help a great deal in being able to satisfy the need your wife has to talk. Now, see, I know, because I do the same thing. I don't like to talk about it. It's like talking to my son about how to learn how to multiply. You know, and if you teach anything at all, it doesn't matter what it is, you know the answer, but it's not the answer that somebody else has to understand. It's how to get to the answer. It's why we're doing this. See, it's not the answer that's important. It's how to get to the answer that's important. Most men will talk in answers, and most women will talk in the process of the decision. And as a man, you need to learn to share that with your wife. The odds are you're going to come to the same decision, and you may have known it 2 minutes into the conversation. It's going to take you till tomorrow to actually say it. But you're going to have to learn to do that and understand that that's how a woman's mind works. And it adds a tremendous amount. Now, again, it requires the thing that God requires of you as a husband, that you give yourself, okay? That you give what you are. Part of that is the time that's attached to it. I want to talk about that separately for a minute. But that's a principle in communication and in talking you need to understand. Okay, there's one other thing that in a relationship of communication is an ingredient that must exist within a marriage. And that is the aspect of praise and complimenting each other. Being able to say when something has been done well, being thankful for it, being grateful for it, and being able to tell your husband or your wife that they have done something that is right and pleasing to you and is good for you. Now, you think it's so obvious that anybody could do it. Sad part about it is, if you were to count up the times you did it today, the likelihood is there wasn't one. Not one time. Not even when you ate dinner, or when you came home and the house was clean, or when you came home and you happened to notice that she ironed all your shirts, or, you know, that's what she's supposed to do. Or that your husband took care of whatever it was in your car that needed to be fixed, even though you'd asked him 20 times that he finally didn't do it, and that you bothered to say, "Thanks a lot, honey, I appreciate the fact that you did that." It's essential in human relationships that gratitude, and communication that is in human relationships, that gratitude, the pleasure, thankfulness, appreciation, and the praise be a part of what's there. Let's just listen to a couple of the things the Proverbs say about it, and you can understand it's important again. Proverbs 15 and verse 4, we read this already, but we'll read it again. Gentle words cause life and health. Literally cause it. They actually cause a person to blossom, feel well, work well. Don't ask me why, aside from the fact that what God says is, what Christ says is, that his words are spirit and truth. And therefore those words have an effect on the mind and the mind on the body. And so it's something that just has to be learned, has to be understood. Proverbs 16:24. Again, we're going to do these hurriedly, just to look at a few of them in principle. Kind words are like honey, enjoyable and healthful. Honey is good for you, and it's fun to eat. Same thing is true about saying kind things, encouraging things, things of praise, of gratitude and appreciation to your husband or your wife. How many times over the course of the day do you do it? Oftentimes it's thought, but it's never verbalized or said. And that's a tragedy, because then the person involved never recognizes how much appreciation there is. I tell my wife how much I appreciate the time she spends answering the phone, because it interrupts her day all day long. I know it does, because it interrupts my day all day long when I'm there. And when I'm at home and she's at home, she answers the phone, because she knows it interrupts me. And so therefore, she will stop and answer the phone and screen the calls. And if they don't have to be done right now, and I can call them back, then I'll do that. If they have to be done right now, then she'll interrupt me and tell me. But the point is that I need to be appreciative that she does that. I am. And I try and tell her, you know, I appreciate it. Because it means when the phone rings, she's got to stop vacuum cleaning, stop cleaning up the kids, stop doing whatever it is she's doing, stop sewing, stop whatever she's involved in, and go answer the phone so that I don't have to do it. And I have to be appreciative of that and say that. Didn't for a long time. But it's smart enough to learn that it was necessary to do, and that it had a value, a real value, in terms of self-worth and appreciation and gratitude for what's been done. Okay, I want to quickly cover the area of time together and how to do that and how important it is. Now, we've covered some of the basic principles of communication within the confines of the structure of marriage as God has established it. Some of these things I'm going to talk about some more on the Sabbath, but it'll give you some groundwork to think about in relationship to them as we come to them. Okay, it is necessary in marriage to make time to be together alone. And that means apart from all of the things that are involved in interrupting in life. That means, for one thing, as far as the need is concerned, apart from sex. Now, you need to be alone when you're involved in sex, and I certainly hope that's obvious and everybody understands that. However, you need to be alone with each other apart from that as part of the relationship, in time for each other. It needs to be apart from the kids. Time alone does not include sitting in front of a television set or being there while the kids are all in bed upstairs, sleeping. And you're sitting down watching the TV set, listening to Johnny Carson, whoever Johnny Carson's replacement is going to be, to stay up that late to watch him, whatever all else is involved. Does not mean that. Time alone is fine, at home or away from home, as long as it is structured to be exactly that. This is something that I learned by example from a fellow by the name of Bob Bertuzzi, who many of you may have known. He told me that, and I paid attention to what he said because I appreciated the relationship I saw between he and his wife. And he said, look, you need to get away from your kids, and you need to get your wife away from your kids, and you need to get away from the family. Whether you ship the kids somewhere or you go somewhere, you have got to do that in order to allow the relationship between you and your wife to grow. That was advice that I was smart enough at a young age to understand. And I began shipping my kids out and letting somebody take them periodically, and sometimes taking their kids for exactly the same reason, in order to have that kind of time with my wife, where she is not tied to. Tonight, I'll tell you what, for all of you that have little kids, you just ask your wives on the way home tonight how much they liked being away from the kids. Take a straw vote and a poll here. I can tell you the answer instantaneously. Now, for you as a husband, see, it's no problem. You walk out the door in the morning, you're away from the kids for 8 or 10 hours every day. But she's not. And especially when children are young, the need to be with you apart from them is very great. And they need to be so, not in a context that is sexual in nature, but that is in appreciation of, that is a part of, that is in companionship with, that is in communication with her as a woman. That is important to both of you to work on and develop. Make a date and keep it, is the way I do it with my wife, as a general rule. We try to do it every 2 weeks, some way or another. I will either take her out, somebody will ask to take the kids, or we'll ship the kids out someplace and we'll go somewhere, and try to do it at least every 2 weeks where it's divorced from anything and anybody else other than the two of us that are involved. And time is separated. Now, people will say, well, it's tied to money. Doesn't mean it has to be tied to money. Doesn't mean that at all. For example, in a situation like tonight is an excellent time to be alone and together with your wife. You got a babysitter, leave an hour early and walk around the mall. You know, hold her hand and walk up and down and talk and watch and look in the stores and just spend the time, the two of you together. It's a tremendous thing to do. Now, it's tied to money because you got to have a babysitter. But sometimes it's not. If you just will work at another way to do it and to establish that time. But you need to make that date and you need to keep it. Once a month, I think, is a little too infrequent. Once a week would be nice, but it's hardly practical. Once every 2 weeks has worked out pretty well for my wife and I for a number of years. And I've been really glad of it, and so has she. Whether it's going out, and depending upon how much money I happen to have, whether I go out and take her to dinner or whether I can't go out and take her to dinner, but just her. Not the kids, not anybody else. Just her, just the two of you alone. That time is absolutely essential involved there. And if you consider it just for a minute, in the context that we've talked about all of these things in relationship to God and what it pictures, who do you want to be there when you want to talk to God? Who do you want to be there when you want to communicate to God about the needs that you have and the things that are necessary for you spiritually? Christ said, go find a closet and shut the door. That's exactly the same thing in the relationship that applies between husband and wife. The principle is more than just a cute little picture of what marriage means. Some of these things apply very directly to what needs to be done within marriage itself and how to do it. It is again a part of what's in Ephesians 5 and verse 25, fulfilling the most important need that your wife has, and that is giving yourself, your time, to her. What is it that is most important in her life? If she is converted and seeking the kingdom of God and trying to live her life based on the structure of marriage we've talked about, it's you as a husband. And if you refuse to give yourself to her, then you do exactly what you would least want God to do to you, and that's shut the door and say, I haven't got time. There are too many other things to do. Too many other things for me to get involved in. Very easy to do. Listen, I know how easy it is to do. Believe me, I know how easy it is to do. And I realize that every man can do it for all the same reasons that I can do it for, and can feel just as justified as I can. The problem is, you'll also eat the fruit of doing that. And the fruit will be very unpleasant in relationship to your wife, and in relationship to what you receive back from your wife and her attitude toward you. So it's essential that you do that. During that period of time, there needs to be the expression of affection, expressing of feelings, of hopes, of fears, of hurts, of pains, of sufferings, of longings, desires, of feelings of insecurity when there's nobody else there to hear them. You don't have to worry about the kids upstairs. Are they asleep or aren't they asleep? Are they listening or aren't they listening? You know, there's nobody else around. There's just the two of you in terms of that time, and those things can be talked about in a way that they can't be talked about in any other circumstance. Okay. A couple is a reflection of the things that they do and of how they apply the principles that are there. They really are. And you can learn a lot about people, a lot about the couples that you're involved with, even those of us that are sitting here. Not that I'm asking you to go around and judge all the people that are here and how good their marriage is or is not. That's not the point. The whole structure of what we're doing is trying to improve them by looking at the principles that are involved in them that work. If you know what those principles are, though, you can begin to generate the fruit of them by trying them, by doing them. You know, it means, however, that you have to be willing to do the same thing you had to be willing to do when you were baptized, and that is repent. And that's a very unpleasant process. Very unpleasant thing to do. I didn't like the period of repentance before I was baptized because I didn't like admitting things about myself that I knew were true, but I didn't like and I didn't want anybody else to know. I didn't want to have to admit that I was wrong and make that change. Well, that same thing is going to apply here in relationship to how these principles are used by you, have been used, or are going to be used from this point on. It's like I said before, you know, I can tell you all these things and I know them all, but I don't do all of them. And there are more than these things that are involved. Still in all, you have to try to do them. You cannot expect and demand perfection out of your husband or wife. You know that? It's not fair. It's not fair for you to demand your husband or your wife to be perfect, but you know, it is fair for you to try and give perfection. Matter of fact, that's the whole structure of what's involved, is how God deals with us, isn't it? He doesn't demand it, but he does expect you to try. Jesus Christ said, "Become perfect, even as my Father in heaven is perfect." It's not related to what anybody else does, it's related to what you do, and that's true in marriage. Whether you're perfect or not at what you do, it's not based on whether your husband or your wife does what's right. It's based on the fact that you are trying to do what's right because of your belief and conviction and conversion and the Spirit of God that's within you. And that's again why I've structured this as far as the Bible studies are concerned on that premise and on that basis. That those of you that are here are converted with that intention of being in God's family, in God's kingdom. Okay, I want to wrap it up with that right now. I do want to recommend a book to you. Now, once again, please, not everything in every book I recommend, like the first 4 minutes I mentioned a little while ago, or this book, do I recommend that you do all of the things that are in there. This guy is not a Christian. He is a psychologist, two of them, in fact, that are involved, three of them that are involved. It is a book that deals with all of the things that are related to the games that people play, as psychologists like to say, in communicating as couples, one to another. It is a very interesting and very useful book. And I think if you read through it, it is geared toward being used by couples. It's a kind of a workbook book for husbands and wives and learning techniques of communication. Now, what I've dealt in tonight are not techniques, but principles of communication based on our understanding of marriage. This book deals in techniques of communication between husbands and wives from a psychological point of view, dealing with the most obvious kinds of problems and the most recurring type in communications in marriage. It is called A Couple's Guide to Communication. Looks like this. Nice yellow book, Couple's Guide to Communication. It is from Gottman. John Gottman is the main name you need on it, I guess. There are four people involved in authoring it, but if you have John Gottman, G-O-T-T-M-A-N. Again, you will find this probably in almost any bookstore. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, and then there are several others that are also psychology professors involved in it. It is a workbook. It is usable. Some of the principles are functional and are within the realm of Christianity. Some of the things that they discuss I do not agree with. So please, if you read through this and you come across something that is a question and you look at it and say, does Mr. Vance believe that? Just guess I don't, and maybe you'll be all right if you have a question about it. If you have something that's a real question about it, you don't know whether you should or you shouldn't, come and ask me. I'll be willing to tell you. I'll stick my neck out and give you my opinion. Sometimes stuck it out a lot further than I ought to, and I've had it cut off, and it has grown back. God has been very merciful to me. Okay, covered enough things for this evening. I appreciate you coming. Any questions you want to ask before we wrap it up and go home? Who's the publisher? I'll give you the Research Press, Champaign, Illinois. Before you go, I want to talk about the subject on the Bible study the next time around. And just briefly, I want to discuss it and ask you if possible that you can get a hold of and read through some of the books that I listed the last time. Next time in February that we come to this class, I want to discuss the relationship sexually between husbands and wives. Hang-ups, problems, all the things that are tied to it. We won't have a lot of time, and I'm going to go over a lot of material in a short period of time, and it will be an enormous help to me if you can read through some of the things that you have already been recommended to read. That includes Mr. Armstrong's book on the missing dimension in sex, Is Sex Sin? It includes The Act of Marriage by Tim LaHaye. Please try and get a hold of that book and read it if you can between now and next month. And also for the wives, particularly husbands too, if you want to sit down and read it. But the book Solomon on Sex, which is the commentary on the book of the Song of Songs in the Old Testament, which is the only book that we have basically geared towards sexual instruction as far as marriage is concerned. So if you will pick those books up and try and read through those between now and the next time that we have the Bible study. I want to cover in here material that I'm not going to cover nor go through on the Sabbath, because as far as sex education is concerned, that's a responsibility you have to teach your children. But oftentimes the hang-ups that exist sexually between husbands and wives are enough to destroy any possibility for them to even teach their children anything about the subject of sex at all. Okay? Any other questions before we say goodnight? You want to ask before we get out of here? I don't want to embarrass anybody by making public any questions, but I will say this, that the next time, too, I do want to try at the end of the Bible study to answer questions about maybe particular things that I could give you some advice on that might be applicable to a specific situation. If such is the case, write the questions down and bring them with you. And I will either attempt to answer them here or in the last sermon that I give about marriage after the next Bible study, I'll try and answer them in that sermon where the principles to deal with. Okay? Thank you very kindly. See you on the side.